Welcome to today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, March 4th. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. And before we get to our first story, there's a big picture on the cover, on the front page of Caitlin Clark. And the headline is Record Breaker. Iowan's Caitlin Clark becomes NCAA's all-time scoring leader. And the caption is, Iowa Hawkeyes guard Caitlin Clark, number 22, celebrates hitting a three-pointer as her team takes a double-digit lead during the Hawkeyes' Big Ten women's basketball game Sunday against Ohio State at Carver Hawkeye Arena in Iowa City. Clark became the all-time NCAA Division I scoring leader Sunday, breaking Pistol Pete Maravich's 54-year-old record with her 18th point of the day against number 2 Ohio State. And we'll probably hear some more about that in the sports section. So, to our first story. Bill affecting regents and public campuses could cost millions. This is by Vanessa Miller. Should the state adopt into law a bill that has passed the Iowa House to restructure the Board of Regents and its powers while capping tuition and diversity programming, Iowa's public campuses face a multi-million dollar hit. New positions, new curricula, and a review of how the public campuses can cut expenses could cost upward of $3.6 million, according to a report from the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency on House File 2558. The bill Thursday cleared the House 56-39, with only Republicans in support and six Republican lawmakers joining the Democrats in opposition. That total doesn't include unknown costs for a new work-study program, a new baccalaureate program, expanded services, and the tuition cap and freeze the bill would impose. But the freeze is expected to have a negative fiscal impact on the university's revenues, according to the agency's fiscal note. The agency reported tuition and fee collection across Iowa's three public universities this academic year was $298.3 million. Under the bill's proposed restrictions, according to the agency, that total would have been $280.6 million, nearly $18 million less, or a 6% reduction. This clearly is a political bill, House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst, a Democrat of Windsor Heights, said Thursday in urging her colleagues to vote against it. It clearly is a bill that creates more inefficiencies, increased costs, reduces services, and puts the accreditation of our region's institutions at risk. The version that cleared the House, becoming eligible for consideration in the Senate, looks somewhat different and more specific than the original proposal. This bill, as originally proposed, would increase the number of Board of Regents members from 9 voting members to 11 total members, including 2 non-voting members appointed from the legislature. While the 9 voting regents still would be appointed by the governor and confirmed by a 2/3 Senate vote, the legislative members would be appointed by the majority leader in the Senate and the speakers of the House. Increased oversight, Representative Taylor Collins, a Republican of Minneapolis, said when Representative Bob Kressig, a Democrat of Cedar Falls, asked him to explain the need for lawmakers on the board. The revised bill would shrink the length of terms of voting regents from 6 years to 4 and hold non-voting members to 2-year stints. The revision also changes the way the board chooses its leadership. Instead of allowing regents to elect a president, like they did earlier this week, choosing Sherry Bates by unanimous vote, the bill would require the board to nominate a president who must then receive Senate confirmation. Addressing how the board hires university presidents, which it touts among its most important tasks, the bill could incorporate legislative say there, too. It would require the board to hire an applicant recommended by a presidential selection committee made up of only members of the board. The bill doesn't specify the committee include only voting regents, meaning legislative non-voting members could serve. And where the universities now unveil finalists for president, typically bringing them to campus for public forums, the bill would keep confidential the identity of a candidate for president of an institute of higher learning being considered by the Presidential Selection Committee, unless committee members agree in writing to disclose a candidate's identity. Where the first version of the bill capped undergraduate tuition increases at 3%, the revised version maintains that cap for incoming students, but also freezes tuition and fees for resident undergraduate students for 4 years. For resident undergrads starting on or after the 2025-26 academic year, tuition and mandatory fees couldn't increase for their first four consecutive years. Rates could go up for students who take longer or who come with transfer credits allowing them to graduate in under 4 years, but don't. The board for the current academic year increased resident undergraduate tuition 3.5%, and it increased the average combined tuition and fee rate for that group of students 4.3% to $10,396.30 a year. Is it worth it to have a capped tuition rate when we are not going to be able to get what I'm going to the University of Northern Iowa for? Comfrist asked, using UNI as an example, and asking what lost revenue could mean for that institution. The problem with the University of Northern Iowa, I believe, is enrollment. So we really felt that this tuition cap would serve as an attraction, Collins said. More students would go to the University of Northern Iowa specifically because of the tuition guarantee. The revised bill bars the universities from creating new administrative positions, defining administrator as vice president, assistant vice president, or associate vice president without regents' approval. And it would codify a list of diversity, equity, and inclusion directives the regents imposed on itself after a study group assessed DEI across the campus on the heels of legislative criticism. It directs the universities to restructure DEI offices to eliminate functions not required by law or accreditation, ensure DEI services are available to everyone, and ensure no one is required to submit a DEI statement or be evaluated based on his or her participation in DEI programming. It would bar the universities from compelling people to disclose their pronouns and require new policies advancing the diversity of intellectual and philosophical perspectives in faculty and staff applicant pools. It would also codify the limited power of faculty senates and committees, allow a university president to initiate post-tenure reviews, and require each university to create an American History and Civics 3-credit course that students must complete before graduating. When it comes to DEI, whether they were created with good intentions or not, it has become clear that they now are ideological enforcement centers that suppress the pursuit of truth and, most importantly, merit, Collins said. This bill stops the pursuit of these distractions and ideological agendas, reorients the focus of our higher education system back to the pursuit of academic excellence, which should have been the point from the start, controls the ever-rising cost of higher education, and gives this body increased oversight over the regent enterprise. Okay, and now to the government notes. Schools ask voters to consider capital project fund. Also, Cedar Rapids Parks and Recreation opens registration for summer programs. Eastern Iowa school districts are asking voters to consider approving a capital project fund in a special election March 5th that would create revenue for the purchase and improvements of grounds, construction, and remodeling of buildings and major equipment purchases. The fund, called the Physical Plant and Equipment Levy, PEPL, is funded by property taxes levied and collected by the school district. Linmar, Marion Independent, and Benton School Districts are asking voters Tuesday to consider approving the PEPL, which school leaders say is integral in maintaining facilities and purchasing vehicles and technology. Polls are open 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Tuesday. Polling places can be found online at iowaauditors.org/elections/voter-information. Because this is a special election, polling places may be different from a general election. A voted PEPL must be approved by a community's voters every 10 years. Linmar and Marion school districts have had the funds in place for more than a decade. If the measures are approved, the PEPL would be extended through 2035 at the existing rate of $1.34 per $1,000 of taxable property value. Benton's previous voter-approved PEPL for the district expired in 2010. Our school district at the time was being fiscally responsible to taxpayers, and we didn't have any major projects planned at the time, so they let it expire, said Benton Superintendent James Biskey. Cedar Rapids City Council advances rezoning for Hawkeye Downs. The Cedar Rapids City Council last week unanimously advanced a request from local auto salvage company Sunline to rezone 43 acres at 4400 6th Street Southwest from general industrial to light industrial with a planned unit development overlay, which would accommodate multiple uses, including possible commercial uses, as Hawkeye Downs looks to build a new expo center. This allows a car racing center, convention hall, outdoor storage, contractors' shops, indoor and outdoor amusement, and a fuel station for the racetrack. Potential future uses include a hotel or motel. It's really nice to see someone step up and take care of that property, Councilmember Ann Poe said. It can be, and I think it has, a vision to be a real asset to our community. Last fall, Sunline cleaned out its property on 6th Street Southwest to make way for the property's sale to Copart, an insurance auto auction. Roger Cassell, owner of Hawkeye Downs and Sunline, previously told the Gazette that Copart bought the land to use it as one of its major locations in the Midwest. Copart currently has Iowa locations in Des Moines and Davenport. The council last year approved rezoning Hawkeye Downs from light industrial to general industrial district to allow for a salvage yard to store the cars from the old Sunline property. A conditional use allowed for a modified proposal to locate the salvage yard and related operations on the western portion of the site behind existing structures instead of its initially proposed location on the east end of the property along 6th Street Southwest. Cedar Rapids Parks and Recreation opens registration for summer programs. Registration is now open for Cedar Rapids Parks and Recreation summer programs and camps. The department's summer program guide, PlayCR, is available online at www.crrec.org and will be mailed to residents beginning today inside the city's Our CR magazine. PlayCR includes approximately 600 programs that run from April through August, as well as pool schedules, golf information and lessons, summer camps, park information, and more. Summer programs include activities for all ages at Northwest Recreation Center, Old McDonald's Farm, and Usher's Ferry Historic Village, sports, swim lessons, and lifeguard certification classes. New offerings include camps at Usher's Ferry, Master Gardener Mini Camps, ISU Extension Mini Camps, Snapology STEAM Summer Camps, dance classes with Faith Kubik, and pickleball leagues and clinics. There are also events such as special days at the pools, summer movie free-for-all, Bubble Mania at Old McDonald's Farm, and Freedom Festival Family Tour Day at Usher's Ferry. To register, go online, in person at Northwest Recreation Center, 1340 11th Street Northwest, or City Services Center, 500 15th Avenue Southwest, or by phone at 319-286-5566. Operating hours at the Northwest Recreation Center are weekdays from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. and 7:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the City Services Center. New summer season pool passes are available this year to grant admission to any water exercise class or age-appropriate open, family, lap, or adult swim. Early bird discounts are available for passes purchased on or before May 18th. New season passes and punch passes can be purchased, and 2023 passes can be renewed online. Passes also may be purchased at the Parks and Recreation Office at City Services Center, the Northwest Recreation Center, or at the outdoor pools when they open. Pool schedules and more information are available at www.crrec.org. A low-income assistance program, Rec Assist, is available for those with financial need. The program offers a discount on swim passes and recreation program to those who qualify. Learn more and apply at cityofcr.com/recassist. Linn County earns Budget Award for 28th consecutive year. Linn County has received the Distinguished Budget Presentation Award from the Government Finance Officers Association of the United States and Canada for its fiscal 2024 budget presentation spanning the budget year that ends June 30th. This is the 28th year in a row that Linn County has received the award that reflects the county's commitment to exceeding the highest principles of governmental budgeting through responsible financial management, according to the news release. Award recipients had to satisfy nationally recognized guidelines for effective budget presentation. These guidelines assess how well a government's budget serves as a policy document, financial plan, operations guide, and a communications device. Members of the association's professional staff and outside reviewers with experience in public sector budgeting review budget documents submitted to the awards program. A document must be rated proficient in all four categories and in the 14 mandatory criteria within those categories to receive the award. According to the association, award recipients have pioneered efforts to improve the quality of budgeting and provide an excellent example for other governments throughout North America. Each year, Linn County holds more than 20 public meetings when developing its budget. The Linn County Board of Supervisors adopts the final budget. Linn County's budget documents are available at linncountyiowa.gov. Iowa City School Board approves potential makeup snow day. The Iowa City School Board last week approved adjusting the 2023-24 school calendar to make April 19th an in-person school makeup day if needed. As of now, April 19th is a no-school day. Currently, the district's last day of school is June 5th. Last month, the school board, in a 5-1 vote, gave school administrators the authority to schedule up to 5 virtual learning days as allowed by Iowa law when in-person learning is not possible. School board member Mitch Lingo voted no. Board member Molly Abraham was not at the meeting. School board members said virtual learning should be a last resort. The district's calendar builds in about 6.5 days to provide days to make up snow days. As of Friday, only 2.5 hours remained of that built-in time. The state requires Iowa school districts to provide 180 school days or 1,080 hours of instruction each year. Iowa City announces retirement of Animal Services Coordinator. Iowa City Animal Services Coordinator Chris Whitmore retired from her position Friday after more than 30 years with the city. Whitmore was hired as an animal service officer in 1993 and promoted to coordinator in 2018. In a news release about her retirement, the city said Whitmore has been highly regarded for her work ethic, professionalism, and passion for providing high-quality and humane animal care and enforcement. With the announcement about Whitmore's retirement, the city also announced Animal Service Officer Devin Streif's promotion to Animal Services Coordinator. Streif will oversee the city's animal services enforcement staff, as well as daily operations for the Iowa City Animal Care and Adoption Center at 3910 Napoleon Lane. Streif was hired as a kennel assistant in March of 2020 and as an animal service officer in April of 2021. Our next story, proposal would tax farmers to help pay for pollution cleanup. This is by Christopher Vondersek out of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. A proposal to tax the fertilizer that Minnesota farmers use to boost crop yields in the hopes of treating nitrate pollution of water in southeastern Minnesota passed its first test Thursday in the state's House Agriculture Committee. "We've probably done more than anybody else to address nitrate pollution," said Representative Rick Hansen, a Democrat of South St. Paul, the bill's author. "But it's not working. Nitrogen-impaired drinking water in Minnesota's farm country has been a gnarled reality for rural landowners with private wells for decades, particularly in the southeastern portion of the state with porous geography." Hansen said the time for encouragement through incentives for corn farmers to stop using fertilizer has passed. "The groundwater pollution in the Driftless region has left private wells, streams, and rivers contaminated, with some rural residents reliant upon bottled water." Under Hansen's measure, ag retailers and vendors for nitrogen fertilizer would pay a 99-cent per ton tax. The tax, expected to draw $3 million, would go to community health boards in 8 southeastern counties to be used on safe drinking water, with priorities for mothers and infants. Martin Larson, who farms near Byron in southeastern Minnesota, told the committee he can measure nitrate leaching in his land from fertilizer application over half a century ago. "We must grow corn and soybeans differently, or grow a crop other than corn and soybeans," Larson said. The bill, which was approved largely on party lines, in a 7-6 vote in the House Agriculture Finance and Policy Committee comes months after the Environmental Protection Agency ordered state authorities to deliver drinking water to residents with contaminated wells in southeastern Minnesota. According to a petition to the EPA filed last year by Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, the Minnesota Well Owners Association and others, roughly 80 residents, used private wells for drinking water in the impacted region. Farmers, many of whom say they are dedicated to the goal of clean water, balked at another fee, especially in a time of downward commodity prices. They already face other taxes for different types of fertilizers. A quicker way to get results would be to have more events like what we saw in Olmsted County, said Dan Glessing, president of the Minnesota Farm Bureau. Last week, farmers gathered in Olmsted County to learn more about precision farming practices, limiting use of nitrogen in fields. In a contentious moment, Lee Helgen, executive director for Minnesota Crop Production Retailers, an association comprising members who would directly pay the tax, pressed onward with testimony after the committee chair, Representative Samantha Vang, Democrat of Brooklyn Center, said his allotted time expired. There's not a compelling nexus in policy between a statewide fertilizer tax and allocating funds for a specific narrow geographic concern, Helgen said, labeling the policy approach defective. That nitrates have drifted into the state's groundwater over decades as the corn crop acreage has increased is not disputed. But what hasn't achieved consensus is the best approach to limit the use of fertilizer, which is largely relied upon by farmers to grow yields and, in some cases, stay on the land in a time of high rental rates. A separate bill brought by Representative Stephen Jacob, a Republican of Altura, to provide farmers with property tax relief for enrollment in the state's Agricultural Water Certification Program is expected to also receive a vote from the committee. Last Monday, the state's Minnesota Pollution Control Agency head told the Senate Agriculture Committee that while nitrate levels in the Mississippi River in southeastern Minnesota had slightly decreased since 2008, such depletion wasn't happening fast enough to alleviate the impaired waterway. "This is like Swiss cheese," said Katrina Kessler, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency commissioner. "The groundwater, the surface water, they are one. It's interconnected." During the same meeting, Senator Nathan Wessenberg, a Republican of Little Falls, urged lawmakers and regulators caution in developing nitrate mitigation strategies that would harm farmers, who he characterized as using best management practices in regard to fertilizer application. Utica, a farm town of about 200 people surrounded by fields in Winona County in southeast Minnesota, is preparing to dig a new, deeper well to a deeper aquifer to find clean water because the city's water is contaminated with nitrate. Its current well house is seen in the bottom center of an aerial photo here. A coalition of environmental groups petitioned the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for intervention last year, saying Minnesota's state and local governments have failed to address the public's health threat to private wells and public drinking water systems. And then we have a picture here of students at a dance party, it looks like. And the caption is, "Senior Gracie Jennings, 18, competes in a hula hoop contest with her classmates during Liberty High School's mini dance marathon in North Liberty on Sunday. The event encourages the community to support those affected by childhood cancer. This year's event is the end result of a year's worth of fundraising efforts, with donations going directly to families for day-to-day expenses such as parking passes, meals, gas money, and toys. Students danced to the Cupid Shuffle during Liberty High School's mini dance marathon at Liberty High School in North Liberty on Sunday." And now we're going to turn to the insight section and read our community letters, our opinion section here. Our first letter, "What is the point of GOP legislation in Iowa?" People say of Republican legislation that cruelty's the point. It's unfair and irresponsible to assign motives to people's actions. But what does this phrase say about some Republican-sponsored legislation? For example, lawmakers justify anti-LGBTQ laws by claiming the need to protect children and women. Never mind, there's no evidence that LGBTQ plus people pose a danger to children and women. These laws, as they say, are a solution in search of a problem. Ask these lawmakers if banning transition health care for transgender minors is cruel. They will likely say it's not. They justify the law by claiming it protects children. Never mind the overwhelming evidence that transition health care saves lives. Ask the same question of transgender people denied the opportunity to live a fulfilling life. They will say the law is cruel, humiliating, and unnecessary. Likewise, Governor Kim Reynolds justifies her near-total abortion ban, currently blocked by a court order, by saying it protects unborn children. But what about pregnant Iowans who wouldn't get needed health care until they were near death, maybe not even then? The Kate Cox case shows that so-called exceptions for the life of the mother are meaningless. A pregnant person in this situation likely considers the abortion ban cruel. A sexual assault victim forced to deliver her attacker's baby probably considers the ban cruel. In the end, justification doesn't matter when a law results in human suffering or death. Ignoring Iowan's pleas to be heard is cruel. Cruelty may not be the point, but it is the result. And that letter was from Gordy Felger of Hiawatha. And our other letter is entitled Marion Schools Levy Taxes Us Twice. Marion Independent School District residents, the school board, sent a mailer saying the PEPL, the physical plant and equipment levy, vote on March 5th would not lead to a property tax increase. This is not factual. There are two taxes on the ballot. There's a property tax levy of up to $1.34 per $1,000 of assessed value for 10 years. If your assessed property value goes up, so does your tax payment, even if the rate is the same. Our assessment always goes up. The current rate is the maximum of $1.34, but the district says that with income surtax offsets, the actual rate this year is 77 cents. Why is the overall rate of 70 cents lower than the actual rate of $1.34? Because of the second tax on the ballot, a state income tax surcharge. There is no cap or time limit on the ballot for that. Like the PEPL tax rate, the income surtax rate also is at the discretion of the board. In 2022, the surtax was 2% for MISD residents. Per the Iowa Department of Revenue, it is now 4% as of 2023. Similar proposals with just slightly different wording were defeated by voters only 4 months ago. Voters already passed a $31 million bond issue in 2021 for major building and infrastructure. Enrollment at MISD has dropped approximately 3.6% over the last decade, but property tax revenue has increased over 33%. We can't afford more taxation. Vote no on the new proposal March 5th. And that was written by John Coppice of Marion. You are listening to the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Rosella Elaine Bentrot, 93, of Springville, passed away on Friday, March 1st, at Cedar Manor Nursing Home in Tipton. The family will greet friends from 4 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday, March 5th, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, March 6th, at the funeral home. Burial will follow at Springville Cemetery in Springville, with a luncheon held afterwards at the Springville American Legion. Rose was born on September 13, 1930, in Wheatland, the daughter of Hans and Bertha Johansson Dirksen. She was a 1948 graduate of Wheatland High School. On January 31, 1951, Rose was united in marriage to Marvin L. Bentrot in Davenport. Together they farmed near Springville. She was a member of the Springville American Legion Auxiliary. Rose enjoyed tractor pulls, farming, puzzles, going to the casino, word searches, and playing euchre. Her greatest joy was spending time with her family and friends and going to her grandson's sporting events. Rose will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved her. Rose is survived and lovingly remembered by her daughter, Gayla Bates of Springville, grandson, Brandon Bates of Springville, four great-grandsons, Braylon, Kylan, Easton, and Elijah. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband Marvin, four sisters, Verna Dirksen, Ella Finnis, Edna Molenbeek, and Arlene Kelding. Memorials may be directed to the family. Suzanne F. Langle, 73, of Manchester, passed away on Friday, March 1st, at the Regional Medical Center in Manchester. She was born July 19, 1950, the daughter of Donald and Donna Duffy Smock in Dubuque. Suzanne attended grade school in Edgewood, Strawberry Point, and Greeley. She went to high school in West Delaware. On June 27, 1967, she was united in marriage to William D. Cozad, Jr. in Cahokia, Missouri. Two sons were born from this union. They divorced in 1984. On February 27, 1987, she was united in marriage to Richard L. Langle in Cedar Rapids. Suzanne worked as a nursing assistant for over 30 years and a few years doing child care. She enjoyed spending time with family and friends, especially spoiling her great-grandkids. Suzanne liked watching NASCAR races, fishing, and taking care of her flowers. She was a big Elvis fan and also enjoyed listening to Merle Haggard and George Strait. Survivors include her husband of 37 years, Richard Langle, two stepsons, Chris Langle of Bettendorf and Josh Langle of Heath, Texas, four grandchildren, Aaron Martinson of Earlville, Haley Krominga of Monticello, Nathan Cozad of North Liberty, Heather Sigrand of Scotch Grove, seven step-grandchildren, Levi and Emma Langle, and Alexis Addison, Jace, Kennedy, and Camden Langle, eight great-grandchildren, Violet and Ruby Martinson, Chloe and Rose Cozad, Orion Krominga, Braden Tucker and Camden Sigrad, two brothers-in-law, Gerald Dunn of Dubuque and Ron Stoker of Princeville, Illinois, her mother-in-law, Arlene Langle of Manchester, and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, her two sisters, Deborah Stoker and Sheila Dunn, her two sons, Rodney and Chad Cozad, father-in-law Ambrose Langle, and great-nephew Carter DeMoss. Private Mass of Christian Burial will be at St. Mark's Catholic Church in Edgewood, Iowa, with Reverend John Hogan presiding. Public visitation is from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, March 6th, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. Interment will be at a later date at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery in Greeley. Doris Cress Hefner, age 89, of Vinton, passed away peacefully on Friday, March 1st, at the Vinton Lutheran Home with her family by her side. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, March 5th, at the Phillips Funeral Home Chapel, 212 East 6th Street in Vinton, with Reverend Brian Channel officiating. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. until service time at the funeral home. Interment will be held at Evergreen Cemetery in Vinton. Fred J. Palumbo of Huntley, Illinois, was 93 when he died peacefully February 3rd with his family by his side. Fred was born October 25, 1930, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Fred and Florence Palumbo. On June 14, 1958, he married Mary Ann Williams. He proudly served in the United States Navy. He was a lifelong accounting and finance professional, dedicating his career to FMC, where he ascended to the role of Chief Financial Officer of the Link Belt Division. Retirement couldn't keep him from his passion. He extended his professional journey by 13 years at Financial Federal Credit Incorporated, where he continued to contribute his expertise. He was a lifelong fan of the Chicago Cubs, along with the Green Bay Packers. He and Mary Ann moved to Del Webb in 2000, where he was an active and devoted member at St. Mary's Catholic Church. His love of his family was evident in all he did, and spending time with his family was his greatest joy. He was a loving husband, father, grandfather, and friend who will be missed by all who knew him. Fred is survived by his wife of 65 years, Mary Ann, his children, Diane Palumbo and David Palumbo, his grandchildren, Samuel, Meehan, Johnny, AJ, and Leah, and by his great-grandchildren, Rhett, Bennett, and Ava Rose. He was preceded in death by his siblings, Rosie, Josie, sister Mary Ann, and by his daughter, Nancy. The wake was held at on Thursday, February 8th, from 5 to 8 at DeFiore Funeral Home. On Friday, February 9th, there was a visitation, followed by a funeral mass at St. Mary's Catholic Church. The service was streamed live on the DeFiore Facebook page. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be contributed directly to St. Mary's Haiti Ministry in honor of Fred's bright personality. Bright colored clothing is encouraged. Okay, I'm a little confused. I think that already took place. But you may contact the funeral home at 847-515-8772 for more information. Suzanne Sue White, 76, of Iowa City, died Friday, March 1st, at her home. A gathering for family and friends will be held from 4 to 7 p.m., Tuesday, March 5th, at Gay and Seehoff Funeral and Cremation Service, 2720 Muscatine Avenue, Iowa City. Funeral services will take place at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, March 6th, at Gay and Seehoff Funeral and Cremation Service. For a complete obituary or to share a thought or memory, visit the Gay and Seehaw Funeral and Cremation Service website at www.gayandseehaw.com. Mary Ann Root, 83, of Cedar Rapids, died on Saturday, February 24th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha from complications from a longtime battle with cancer. Services will be at a later date. Tehan Funeral Home and Cremation is serving the family. Mary Ann is survived by her husband of 63 years, Larry, daughter Cheryl Maron of North Liberty, and Cara Sanford of Cedar Rapids, son Alan Root of Norway, 8 grandchildren, Kevin, Janine, Shannon, Sean, Michael, Benjamin, James, and Jordan, several great-grandchildren, many nieces, nephews, and cousins, special friends Joanne Ward and Brenda West Chase, and sister-in-law Marjorie Asby. She was preceded in death by her parents, brother David Asby, sister Janet Schroeder, and son-in-law Robert Mahran. Mary Ann was born on January 25, 1941, in Burlington, the daughter of Frederick and Ethel Bolin Asby. In 1958, she graduated from Danville High School. Mary Ann attended Iowa State University and graduated with an accounting degree from Mount Mercy College. On June 4, 1960, she married Larry Root in Danville. Mary Ann worked for the Sisters of Mercy as an accountant for 10 years and the Black & Decker Company in Baltimore, Maryland. She was a member of Lovely Lane Methodist Church, was a volunteer at Hospice and Stevens Ministry. Mary Ann was a quiet, gentle woman with a smile everyone loved to see. She always went out of her way to be a great friend. Mary Ann liked researching the genealogy of her Bolin and Asby families and enjoyed wintering in Green Valley, Arizona. Most of all, Mary Ann loved spending time with her family, and she will be missed. Joanne Jojo G. Walgamuth of Cedar Rapids was age 58 when she passed away at the Living Center West Nursing Home on Wednesday, February 28th, with Diane by her side. Per Jojo's request, there are to be no services at this time. Jojo was born on August 20, 1965, in Hanau, West Germany. She was the daughter of the late Elke Wolgemuth. She enjoyed crocheting, doing jigsaw puzzles, watching crime shows, playing her coloring games on her phone, and reminiscing about her 1967 Mercury. Jojo loved her coffee and her cigarettes. Her greatest joy was her friendship she had with her daughter, Brittany. Those left to cherish Jojo's memory are her children, Chris Bergen, Adam Walderbach, Brittany Walderbach, Allie Walderbach, and Cassie Walderbach, all of Cedar Rapids. Her grandchildren, Will Bergen, Evie Walderbach, Micah Williams, and the late Lilia Gilson. Her sister, Diane Acker of Hiawatha, and her brother, Gene Merrifield of Michigan. She was preceded in death by her mother, the love of her life, Don Walderbach, and her father, Ray Merrifield. The family would like to thank the entire staff at the Living Center West and St. Luke's Hospice for all the love and support they showed Jojo while she was in their care. Judith Judy Rice, 80, of Cedar Rapids, died Saturday, March 2nd at Evergreen Estates. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. until 11 a.m. Thursday, March 7th at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Celebration of Life services will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, March 7th at Brosh Chapel. Burial will be in Rogers Grove Cemetery in Ely. Judith was born November 3, 1943, in Kentucky, the daughter of Robert and Mary Vogel Blankenship. She was united in marriage to Jim Rice on August 18, 1976, in Rock Island, Illinois. She worked at Holiday Inn, Heritage Acres Nursing Home, as well as in-home daycare provider. Judy enjoyed going to garage sales and most of all spending time with her family, especially the grandchildren. Judy is survived by her daughter Chris Accord, her son Daniel Brown, her many grandchildren and great-grandchildren, as well as her nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, daughter Becky, and her siblings. Memorials may be directed to the family. Stella Ruth Martin, 78, of Cedar Rapids, passed away in the comfort of her home in Cedar Rapids on Wednesday, February 28th, surrounded by her loving family. A visitation will be held at the Word of Faith Church, 2325 16th Avenue Southwest, on Friday, March 8th, from 11 a.m. until service time at 12 p.m., with Pastor Patrick Beetz officiating. Interment to follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery Garden of the Last Supper. Stella was born on March 16, 1945, in Louise, Mississippi. She was the daughter of the late Bob and Johnny May Brown Dixon. On January 6, Stella married the love of her life, Edward Martin, in Cedar Rapids. Her greatest joy was being a mother and grandmother to her amazing family. She loved to joke, laugh, and cook. Those left to cherish Stella's memory are her children, Robert Washington, Levi Washington, Edward Martin III, Cynthia Martin, Arthur Dixon, Bob Dixon, Cora Dixon, Tonya Servin, Tony Martin, and Edwina Esmoyle. 14 grandchildren, 8 great-grandchildren, and her sister Bobby Mims. She was preceded in death by her husband, her parents, her daughter, Brendley Dixon, her sisters, Ella Murphy, Johnny May Ray, Coralie Cooks, her brothers, Alvin Cooks, Luther Dixon, Ben Mims, and Eugene Murphy. Son-in-laws, Saul Servin and Terry Eosi, and her brother and sister-in-laws. Okay, we're now going to turn to the sports section, and let's take a look at what's going on today that you might be able to catch online or on TV. Boys basketball state tournament is taking place at Wells Fargo Arena. It says on television, I'm not sure what channel. It doesn't say what channel. So, in the NHL, tonight on NBCS Chicago, the Blackhawks will be at the Avalanche at 8 p.m. In the NBA, the Clippers are at the Bucks at 7 p.m. on NBA TV. The Thunder at the Lakers at 9:30 p.m. on NBA TV. And the Bulls at the Kings at 11 p.m. It will be joined in progress on NBCS Chicago. In men's basketball, Duke is at North Carolina State at 6 p.m. on ESPN. And Texas is at Baylor at 8 p.m. on ESPN. Weber State is at Montana State at 8 p.m. on ESPNU. Pro soccer today, Sheffield United versus Arsenal will be at 2 p.m. on the USA Channel. And looks like the women's golf, you can catch the 2024 Darius Rucker Intercollegiate match at 1:30 p.m. on the Golf Channel. And here you can catch boys basketball. They're saying on crmlivesports.com. I feel like that may be over, though. That was a morning game between North Lynn and Woodbine. Okay, we're going to go to an article on boys basketball. A chance at redemption for number one Kennedy at state. Unbeaten, top-ranked, and top-seeded again in Class 4A, Kennedy vows not to let history repeat itself this week. This is by Jeff Johnson. The negative Nellies are out there ready to pounce. The naysayers, the I-told-you-so crowd. They want to howl. Cedar Rapids Kennedy's boys basketball team isn't oblivious to them. The Cougars went through last season undefeated and rarely challenged, a number one ranked and seeded team that was stunned in its Class 4A state tournament quarterfinal by Pleasant Valley. Kennedy went through this season undefeated and rarely challenged again. It's number one ranked, number one seeded again in 4A for this week's state tournament. The eighth seeded opponent this time around is Dallas Center Grimes, whose record is 20-3. A quarterfinal slated for Wednesday morning at 10:30. There will be Cougar doubters once more. Prove it, they say. We intend to, says Kennedy. I mean, there's always pressure, said Kennedy guard Trey McCowan. Pressure is privilege for us, honestly. We've earned that pressure, the right to have that pressure, and I think we just have to come out every day and perform. Play like your practice has been the mantra for this group. Kennedy coach John McCowan said his team has practiced hard and with purpose virtually without fail all season, from the first one held in November to the 60-whatever it is up to now. Kennedy's record is 23-0, beat five teams in the regular season that finished in the Iowa High School Athletic Association's final Class 4A Top 10. It beat three teams that are also in this 4A state tournament field, West Des Moines Valley, Cedar Falls, and Dubuque Senior. It has beaten opponents by an average of 35.9 points and gives up just 42 points per game, tied for the lowest in Class 4A. Those numbers are the byproduct of a scrambling pressure defense that creates turnovers and large runs. "We're just going to come out and play our game," said Kennedy's Joe Bean. "Do what we do best, play defense." Bean transferred this season from Cedar Rapids Xavier, where he was part of a team that played in the Class 3A state championship game last year. He doesn't know the heartbreak most of his current teammates felt in Des Moines. It didn't feel real, Kennedy's Micah Schlack said of the 57-45 loss to PV. "I think we did an interview earlier in the season where I said we just have to take every game seriously. I go back to that. We have to take every single game seriously." "We just take every game one by one," said Kennedy's Cyrus Courtney. "You know, of course, everybody is going to have that in the back of their head, of that loss we had last year. But if we play like we practice, we should be fine." Coach McCowan was asked what he could do to help relax his team, to have it play to its optimum capability. He said everyone will talk about last year, but obviously not too much. Use it as a learning lesson, as motivation. "You try a bunch of different things. You talk through a lot of situations," McCowan said. "But at the end of the day, they kind of got to figure it out for themselves a little bit. They've got to be able to control their emotions." A 57-55 sub-state final win last week over North Scott at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse in Cedar Rapids should help. Kennedy scored the first 12 points of the game and seemed en route to yet another rout, but North Scott regrouped and actually had a two-point lead with a minute and a half to go. The Cougars didn't fold, tying it on a Trey McCowan jumper, then going ahead by two on a pair of Bean free throws with 4.6 seconds left. North Scott missed a potential game-winning three-pointer at the buzzer. "That shot was in the air, and you could have gotten beat," Coach McCowan said. "You start to appreciate every day a little bit more. You can talk about it. We've talked about it a lot, that every day in the postseason is a bonus. But now I think that you can really feel that it's a bonus. Hopefully it relaxes us a little bit more. Last year when we played down there in Des Moines, we were really tight and things didn't go well." And let's talk about the girls' state. North Lynn sizzles. Lynx shoot 64%, 71% in the first half, and outgun Newell Fonda 67-51. This was out of Des Moines. North Lynn wasn't perfect, but it was in the vicinity. "We were unbelievable," Coach Brian Wheatley said. "We picked the biggest game to play our best game of the year." Top-ranked North Lynn hit 64% of its shots, 71% in the first half, and outgunned number 2 Newell Fonda 67-51 for the Class 1A Girls Basketball Championship Saturday night at Wells Fargo Arena. "We've been waiting for this for 4 years," Macy Bogie said after earning all-tournament captain honors. "I'm so proud, so happy." The Lynx, whose record was 26-1, won their second title in program history. The other was a Class 2A crown in 2020. They finished the season with 25 consecutive wins. Their lone loss was a 45-44 setback to Clear Creek Amana, the eventual 4A state champion, at Rivalry Saturday in November. This was a game that resembled an intra-squad scrimmage between two teams that love to play fast. North Lynn didn't miss. "You've just got to tip your hat sometimes," Newell Fonda coach Dick Junger said. "We couldn't turn the faucet off. If the other team hits 64%, either you have to force a lot of turnovers or win the rebounding effort." Instead, now hold on 1 second, because I lost my place here. Oh, I'm so sorry. Here we go. Instead, the Lynx coughed it up just 9 times, an admirable number against a team like that. And they out-rebounded the Mustangs, whose record was 24-3, by a 20-17 margin. Of course, there weren't many rebounds to be had. Down 7-3 early, the Lynx struck for 16 points in the final 4 minutes 15 seconds of the first quarter, after which they led 19-11. They were just getting warmed up. North Lynn hit 10 of 11 attempts, all of its last 8, in the second period and took a 40-23 lead into intermission. "This was the moment we wanted to be in," Molly Bogie said. "It gave us so much confidence." Cameron Kurt said, "I just had this feeling that we were going to shoot well. Then we were able to finish around the basket." A run by the Mustangs seemed inevitable, and they did close within 45-34 midway through the third quarter. But Macy Bogie drilled a 3-pointer, Kurt scored on a drive, and Allie Hoggenbury sank 2 free throws to make it 52-34, and the Lynx were never seriously threatened. "To beat Newell Fonda, you have to play a fundamentally sound game," Wheatley said. "We stuck to our fundamentals and we executed our game plan," said Kurt, who led all scorers with 23 points and dished out 7 assists. And now we'll look at college basketball. UNI grabs big win at Southern Illinois. This is men's basketball. Panthers could get the 4 seed in MVC tournament and a bye. By Cole Bear. Northern Iowa's offense outdueled Southern Illinois Missouri Valley Conference leading defense at Banterra Center Sunday afternoon for an 82-70 men's basketball win. UNI, whose record is 18-13, 12-8 in the conference, built its largest lead of 13 for a fourth time with a Nate Heiss fast break layup with 10 minutes 44 seconds remaining. But the Salukis, whose record was 19-12, 11-9 in the conference, offered their first of 2 comeback bids in response, drawing within 2 possessions at 62-57 with just over 8 minutes remaining after a pair of 3-pointers from Jarrett Hensley and A.J. Ferguson and 2 free throws from Xavier Johnson. The Panthers then counterpunched with a quick 6-0 run to extend their lead to 11, but saw it trim back to 6 after a driving layup from Kennard Davis Jr. and a 3 from Troy D'Amico. UNI's newest perimeter threat then stepped up for the second time in the past 3 games, pushing the lead back into double digits where it stayed, as back-to-back Jacob Hudson threes built the lead to 74-62 with 3 minutes 55 seconds left to play. The start of the second half was good, and then when we had that nice lead, 12-13-point lead, and they cut it to 5 with 2 threes and a quick basket, those 2 moments in the game were just really impressive by the guys, UNI coach Ben Jacobson said on the Panthers Sports Network post-game show. A driving layup from Heisey when combined 6 made free throws from Bowen Bourne, Titan Anderson, and Heisey over the game's final 1 minute 28 seconds ultimately sealed a much-needed win. Along with impressively outdueling the MVC's top-ranked defense on its home court, Heisey and Trey Campbell factored largely into an inefficient afternoon for MVC leading scorer Xavier Johnson. Johnson shot just 35% from the field as he had to grind his way to a game-high 24 points. For Trey and Nate in particular, they were guarding Johnson the most today. To be able to go back and forth a little bit was important, Jacobson said. In the second half, Nate guarded him for 5 or 6 minutes. Then Trey had that 4 to 5 minute stretch. Then we were able to come back again with Nate. Just felt like that was important and that was key. Needing Sunday's win for a chance at the MVC tournament's 4 seed and a first-round bye, UNI's offense provided a much-needed and well-timed performance, shooting an efficient 61% in the second half and 49% for the game. Tied at 34 at halftime, the Panthers continued to find productivity with their newfound ethos over the now past 6 games, playing hard and fast, en route to 18 fast break points and 17 points off turnovers. "The guys have done such a great job of playing faster," Jacobson said. "The difference is we're playing harder and we're playing more physical defensively. I would tell you the third part is how fast we're playing, how fast the ball gets on top of other teams. To get 18 fast break points in this building, that's a job well done." 4 Panthers finished in double figures. Bourne scored a team-high 19 points. Hudson finished with 15 points, making 3 of 5 three-point attempts, and Anderson and Campbell scored 15 and 11, respectively. There's no question we're playing, over the last 2.5, 3 weeks, the best we've played all year, Jacobson said. We're playing our best basketball right now. And just briefly, we're going to recap the Caitlin Clark story here. Iowa's Clark marches past Maravich in a big win over number 2 Ohio State. Caitlin Clark completed her season-long series of record-setting moments, and 6th-ranked Iowa kept that revolving door at number 2 spinning with a 93-83 women's basketball victory over Ohio State before a vocal crowd of 14,998 on Sunday at Carver Hawkeye Arena. It was the 9th time this season the number 2 team and the Associated Press poll took a tumble. But, as Clark said, this was no upset. This was a game we should win, she said. We were favored. It was senior day. We had a lot of confidence. I feel we played a dominant basketball game. We were in control the entire time. We played a good, complete game. Iowa finished the regular season at 26-4 overall, 15-3 in the Big Ten, a game behind the league champion Buckeyes, whose record is 25-4 and 16-2 in the conference. The Hawkeyes will be the 2 seed in the Big Ten tournament and will play their quarterfinal game at 5:30 p.m. Friday at the Target Center in Minneapolis. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.